So my next guest on Crossing the Pond is somebody who's been at the forefront of transatlantic B2B communications for many, many years, and particularly has been focused on the investor side of that process. And so it gives me great, great pleasure to introduce a good friend of mine, Chris Newton, who I first started working with 25 years ago, let's say, when I was doing some PR for NetApp. And Chris, your career has had many different twists and turns, but you've been a B2B tech expert for many, many of those years. So I was wondering, as we get started, could you just tell us a little bit about your career history to date?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Great to be a part of this. You know, so I started at NetApp about 25 years ago when we were both small children. You know, I wasn't involved in communications at the time, but slowly worked my way into communications roles, really trying to leverage my desire to sway other people's opinions and debate. So it was ended up being a great role for me. I started doing industry analyst relations, which in the tech world is, you know, super important. Those are people who influence buying. Then I moved into corporate communications, so kind of overseeing PR and social and other roles, and then worked my way into the specialty of investor communications. Really at the heart of my entire career has been focused on, you know, advocating for, you know, my company and the value that we bring to different constituencies.
I'm so glad that we get the chance to speak. And your career history, I think, is going to be very much one that other people who are listening to this podcast will relate to, because I believe that a great many of us, myself included, didn't get born wanting to do B2B PR and B2B communications for tech companies. It's something that we get drawn into and we kind of drift into and then make something of. And I think that that is great, because I think it reflects the passion and talent of the individuals concerned. But the downside of that is that many of us are in roles whereby there isn't a lot of training, there isn't a lot of experience and expertise around us to draw upon. And I think that's still the case. So I just wanted to take you back to the early days when all of a sudden you started to become responsible for communications at NetApp. Who did you learn from? How did you figure out what to do and all the different protocols and technologies around it?
I mean, it's a great question, and it is definitely a learn on the job, learn as you go, try and crowdsource as much information as you can. A lot of it, though, is just practical, right? Like, how would you like to be communicated to? What types of things do you think people should know? My approach when I've had a finite audience that I can kind of think of as a group is to, like, what's their mental map look like? Like, where are they in terms of like their views on whatever topic or company I'm thinking about? And then where do I need them to go? And then try and like create that course between A and B so that you can start to move people down a line.
That's so interesting, because you're reflecting and you're expressing in a slightly different way a conversation that Eric Brown and I had yesterday, in fact. And for him, the big thing is being able to empathize with the audience that you're looking to target and looking to speak to. And of course, this podcast is designed for people in North America who are looking at transatlantic communications and for whom it may be very difficult to really get a handle on this remote little island in the middle of the Atlantic that speaks kind of the same language, is hugely important. I mean, how did you go about doing that in the early days? And do you think it's any easier today?
I think it's harder today.
Interesting.
For a lot of reasons. But I was lucky because I learned a lot from Eric in the early years. I mean, he is definitely one of the tech communication greats. You know, I think his approach is one that makes a lot of sense. Like, where is your audience? And how do you kind of think of them as where they are? You know, today in investor communications, the story that I'm telling is the same globally, right? Like, our revenue is our revenue. That doesn't really change depending on who I'm talking to. But you have to recognize that, you know, different investors and especially people like in the UK have different priority sets on things where they're interested in things in a slightly different way. So you have to take your common story and think about like what matters to your audience. And yeah, I would say the geopolitical environment has made any sort of communications much more difficult.
Yes, no doubt. And I don't think it's going to get easier anytime soon by the looks of things.
No.
But you said also you think it's harder today than it was in our day. Talk to me a little bit about that and why you think it's harder today.
You know, back in the day, there were fewer modes of communication, right? You had a lot more control over the channels that you were dealing with. And it was, you know, the corporate voice had a lot more weight. Today, you've got like this multimodal channel. You've got individuals who have as much or even a bigger voice in some topics than the corporate does. And trying to manage through all of that and keep track of it and on top of it can be really daunting.
Yeah, overwhelming and almost an impossible task, actually, with everything that's out there. Things have changed a lot since we first started talking with each other and working together. I think one of the things that I notice has changed a lot is control, the need for control of messaging. And the ability to control messaging seems to have really changed. And also the tolerance for diversification in terms of the way that a message lands. I think back in the day, it was almost prescriptive. Journalists were expected to write the copy that was provided to them or their version of that. Today, there is not that same degree of control with a credible editorial outlet. Would you agree?
I would totally agree. And you can't control the voices that are speaking about you as much as you used to be able to, right? So you not only used to have journalists that had like a very finite channel and they were a little bit more willing to take the company's lead and listen to the message you were trying to deliver and echo that for you. But, you know, today I feel like they're a lot more freewheeling. Plus you've got all these other voices that are kind of confounding your message, right? And potentially muddying the waters for you.
This podcast is designed to speak to people who are in the throes of that process or at the beginning of that process. What advice would you give if Chris Newton was starting today in B2B comms with a transatlantic brief, such as the one that you had? What advice would you give Chris Newton today, apart from run?
Right, exactly. Like, rethink your choices. You know, I think one is if you try and control everything, you will lose your grip on things faster than if you kind of accept that things are outside of your control and you have to be a little bit more willing to go with the drift and flow with things. I am personally a control freak, and so that can be quite hard for me. I want to know everything that's happening. I want to be able to herd it and shepherd it along, but that just isn't possible in today's world. And so kind of giving in and being more flexible and fluid to the way communications happen today, I think is really important. Oh, that would be my advice to myself is like, you know, like let go and trust the process.
That's fine for your own peace of mind, perhaps. But if I'm a B2B marketer today, I'm having to deal with a board of directors who may not be as flexible or, I mean, has that been?
They are not.
And particularly when you talk about the UK, you know, we've got the Register, we've got this sort of tabloid style reporting that we see across the IT trade and business press. What advice would you give to a B2B marketer that had to educate and inform a board of directors in North America about what's going on in the UK?
You know, I think companies like the Register exist everywhere. And so being able to speak holistically to the idea that there are sensationalist journalism out there and people who are looking to create clicks, and no matter what your story is they're going to find a way to discount it or question it. You know, I find the board of directors can be really challenging because, right, you know, your company is essentially their baby. And so no one likes to hear that the baby is ugly. But at times there are issues that you have to be able to acknowledge and then, right, make a plan forward, right? Like, just wishing that everyone thought you were as pretty as you wish you were isn't a strategy. You have to acknowledge where there are problems and like figure out how you address them. And I think that's, you know, not just with the Register, other clickbait kind of journalists, right? That is a fundamental fact of communications, and trying to explain that to the board is really important.
And so I was particularly interested to talk to you because you went through some stuff during the past sort of 10 to 15 years in terms of you were operating in a market that, for people who are listening that don't understand the data center technology industry, there's been some massive moves and acquisitions and mergers and competitive. And in your role, leading the charge in terms of the communications with the investor community, a slip up can be critical, can be fatal, and it's in a world of chaos. So aside from avoiding a nervous breakdown, which I don't know how you did that, but what tips and tricks did you adopt in order to get through the chaos and the mayhem that was the world that you were living in?
Yeah, I mean, there was a period of time where I was just afraid to say anything because I thought I was going to end up in an orange jumpsuit. it's definitely not my color.
It's still time.
Yeah, it's true. I'm not retired yet. Really trying to find the part of the story that you fundamentally believe in and can advocate from a place of authenticity is really important, right? People can tell when you're inauthentic. So, believing in your story and finding wherever it is in your personal world that you can like advocate from a place of authenticity is really important. Finding a core through line that you can stick to is also critically important, right? It's so easy in this world to get distracted by like all the different things, and you've got internal constituents who want their little tiny thing to get as much, you know, airtime as like a big thing. And you've got to find a way to like tell them no or incorporate it into a broader story. All of that gets really challenging. But if you can just like find your place where you truly believe what you're saying and stick to a very simple story, regardless of what things are coming at you, I think that's the key.
I love this because I think that what you're sharing at this point in time, probably it would have been great for us all at the beginning of this process to have heard an expert to say, look, you're not going mad. It is crazy. It's unpredictable. And it's not you. This is just this is the reality of it. Because I don't think people say that. I think that that leads to some of the kind of imposter syndrome that people suffer from because the chaos is so unpredictable. But you also mentioned authenticity. Now, as a Brit, I look at the US and North American media and journalists and spokespeople and the hyperbole that tends to come from fast growth tech innovators and startups and founders. And in my experience, the British media have got even less tolerance for that than the American media. In fact, I would say that the American media are quite indulgent of that sometimes, whereas I don't think the British media is. So if... Do you agree with those? First of all, do you agree with that? Did you find that to be the case?
Oh, definitely. The American media has a hero worship for tech innovators that is weird.
But of course, if I am in your job in North America, I'm surrounded by tech innovators who are used to and acclimatized to the environment whereby there's this hero worship going on around them. And all of a sudden, it's your job to take me to the United Kingdom where I'm not going to get that degree of deference and respect. What advice would you give to somebody in that situation who's dealing with a spokesperson who's perhaps used to the North American media?
That is really hard, right? Because you can tell people to expect to not get the kind of deference that they're used to, but until they're actually in it, no one really believes it, right? Like you have to experience it before you can truly see it. And no amount of like briefing and prep gets spokespeople all the information that you need. Like you can tell them everything and they're still going to be like, oh my God, I wasn't expecting that. I'm not sure that there's a silver bullet to that. If you find one, please do let me know because it is challenging.
I think that the fact that even there's somebody acknowledging, somebody who's been there, done that and got the t-shirt, acknowledging, yes, this is a problem, it is difficult and it's not you, hopefully will be of some value to the people who are listening in on this, who are probably feeling very alone. I mean, particularly in this hybrid work environment, whereby people are working from home and don't have that support network that we would have had in the office. I would imagine that listening to somebody such as yourself saying, yeah, it is tough and there's no perfect solution would be reassuring, because at least they're not missing something that already exists.
Right. Well, definitely, if you're struggling with that, you're not alone out there. I think everyone struggles with preparing spokespeople for things that go sideways, or not even sideways, but just not exactly how they had envisioned or expected things to go.
Yeah. The next question I wanted to ask you is about spokespeople and media training, because you've had to work with super senior executives of multi-billion dollar businesses that have been really in the eye of the storm in terms of M&A stories and deals going through or not going through and what have you. Talk to me about how do you do media training specifically for a spokesperson that's coming to the UK? How have you approached that in the past?
I think the biggest thing with media training when dealing with like senior executives is like, don't get freaked out by them. They're just normal people, and like treat them like you would treat anyone else. Sometimes it can be good to be a little less deferential with them. And when you're preparing them, I try and do role playing. So like, here's a really difficult question I think you're going to get, and how are you going to respond to it? It's interesting because I get a lot of pushback where they're like, that's I don't like that question. Don't ask it of me.
Yeah.
Like, well, come on. Like, that's not even realistic. So trying to make them aware that, you know, their personal distortion field isn't going to work with media, and especially UK media, who do tend to be a little tougher, is important. But again, they're never going to truly believe it until they're in the thick of it.
They feel it. Yeah, exactly. Okay, the next question I wanted to ask you about, you're dealing with the investor community. These people, and they're your spokespeople, your business executives, they're used to numbers, they're used to measurement, they're used to performance and metrics. How do you measure the impact of investor relations and public relations in that context?
You know, it's hard. I know people love to put like numbers to communications functions, like, oh, we reached this and these are the eyeballs and this is the message pull through. But I'm not sure any of that is real. I'm really super skeptical of any comms person who like comes to me with numbers. You have to look at like how much of your message landed. What do you see in terms of pull through? I think it's a much more qualitative analysis than most people are comfortable with, especially in tech, where people like to be able to measure and have really quantitative metrics.
Okay. And so that's particularly interesting because, of course, if a business is contemplating extending its communications plan to target the United Kingdom from North America, that requires investment in terms of time, in terms of talent, in terms of effort, but also in terms of money. How would somebody, if somebody's a new CMO or a new B2B comms leader in a business, talk to me about budgeting, setting budgets for investor relations.
You know, IR, I think, is a little bit different than some of the other more traditional comms roles because, right, you really have a very limited set of spokespeople and you tend to do everything yourself. And for some reason, no one likes to give you money in investor relations. But I think having like a local agency when you're doing broader communications efforts and marketing efforts is really critical. You know, again, it's back to that. You've got one message that you need to deliver globally, but you need to craft it so that it lands appropriately locally. And so having someone who's local and understands local markets and can help you understand like what are the hot buttons in the UK versus in the US and how do you attach to that, I think is critically important.
And then my last question in terms of the B2B marketing function in the UK or the B2B communications function in the UK, any specific things that you were surprised by in terms of the difference between the UK and North America that you think it would be worthwhile people hearing and understanding as they embark on their own journey?
I would say, even though the UK has a reputation for being like tougher and like more challenging in media interviews, they're also a lot more buttoned up. And so, right, in the US, you can play kind of fast and loose and you can use a lot of buzzwords and, you know, shock and awe. And I don't think that works as well in the UK. I think you really have to have some sort of substantial message that you're delivering. And really be confident in whatever that is.
Fabulous. I love that. The other thing that I was going to ask you about was competitors. In America, it seems to me that there was at least a time when it was relaxed when it came to talking about competitors, perhaps criticizing competitors, where it's kind of frowned upon here in the UK. I think that might be one of those things that's a nuance between both regions.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is something to the US of like, you know, take the gloves off and like, you know, fight dirty in the public that all the tech companies love to do. But I am seeing more and more sort of a less of a willingness to say competitors' names and less of a willingness to kind of get in the mud from executive spokespeople and instead drive that down into blogs and other areas where I do think it's more appropriate. I always try and get my spokespeople to think, you're not trying to react to the competition. You're trying to explain why your point of view is the right point of view, why you're better. And you need to, it's all about me. Talk about me, 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 not about anyone else. It can be hard to do in some ways because it is challenging to really articulate your value proposition in a clear and concise way. I think it's a thing that all tech companies struggle with. We all sound identical, right? We're all cloud-based and elastic and AI-driven. Like, I mean, it all sounds the same.
I was at a trade show in London last week. Every exhibitor had the same adjectives on all of their stands, just in different colors. And I thought, if I was a buyer, in fact, Gartner did some research that showed that being a B2B buyer and probably being a B2B investor is harder than ever because of all the information that's available and all the contradictory information that's available. So the world, I think, has just become ever more complex. My final question, I'm asking this of everybody that we're doing this podcast with. Do you have a favorite business book that you would recommend to anybody responsible for B2B marketing in a transatlantic role?
No, I am the worst when it comes to, you know, self-educating on things like that. I really hate business books. Since I graduated from B school, I've stopped reading them altogether.
So the advice is don't waste your time on business books.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Chris, that's been fantastic. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And I really enjoyed speaking to you today. Thank you very much.
It was a great conversation as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Chris.